Welcome to Rewire with Brian Coons, a podcast that explores human potential. If this content is useful to you, please rate or share with your friends and loved ones. Welcome to Rewire Podcast. Today I have a special guest. I have with me Dr. Linda McDonald. Dr. McDonald has been practicing as a family physician for over 30 years and has been on staff at the University of Toronto Health and Counseling Center for over 20 years. Through her exposure and experience, she came to appreciate the limitations within the healthcare system. This awareness led her to become a mindfulness teacher to help people improve their lives through awareness of our attitudes, thoughts, beliefs, emotions, and relationships. Dr. McDonald's meditation experience began over a decade ago with Dr. Stephane Gervais at the Mindfulness Center in Oakville, and when she took the introductory mindfulness-based stress reduction program. Since then, she's gone on to study with some of the top thought leaders in the world and teachers across various disciplines, leaders such as Jon Kabat-Zinn, Zaki Santarello, Zindel Siegel, Dr. Jean Christeller, Jack Kornfield, Daniel Siegel, Kristen Neff, Christopher Germer, to name a few. And I really think that's quite a few of them. That's a lot of the main ones. She currently is leading the mindfulness-based stress reduction program at the Mindfulness Center in Oakville. And I must add as well that she is one of the most authentically kind people I've met. It is really an honor to have you here today, Dr. McDonald. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yes, perfect. So it's interesting. How did you actually discover Dr. Gervais' Mindfulness Center? And when you actually went to approach him, was teaching an intention of yours back then, or did you just take it out of interest?
Well, that's a great question. That takes me back quite a few years now, probably closer to 20, I must admit. But, I came to mindfulness as most people do, really, from my own sufferings, my own uneasiness in life, you would say. And I remember exactly the day I was sitting in my family practice office, and one of the Mindfulness Center pamphlets came by in the stack of incoming mail. And it was at a particularly rough day, I think, a rough patch. And I thought, wow, I need this, help to reduce anxiety and stress and yada, yada. So I just, in that moment, picked up the phone. And who should answer the phone but Dr. Gervais? And in a moment's notice, I had an appointment, and that's how it all started. So I had absolutely no intention of teaching. I didn't even really understand what mindfulness was, but I was just drawn to any ease that which it could bring to my life at that point.
Yeah. Right. That's kind of funny you mentioned that. My story is sort of similar, only at the time I was building a software platform, a corporate wellness platform, and I was looking to incorporate mindfulness in this for corporations. And I found Dr. T just from just on Googling, and he seemed like had the biggest center around. Mm-hmm. And he picked up the phone when I called, and I said, I want to be a mindfulness teacher. And he laughed at me. He said, okay, I don't think so. So that's how it started with him for me. But yeah, he doesn't pull any punches. So you joined the program, obviously, mm-hmm. you fell in love with it. Where did the transition from traditional medicine come to the mindfulness space?
Well, it's not that I fell in love with it initially, I must say. I mean, as you have probably experienced yourself, it's a bit of an arduous path initially. It takes a lot of perseverance and patience, and you meet parts of yourself that maybe you tried to ignore it for many years. But be that as it may, I did, I guess you could say, fall in love with the notion and what I was learning about myself and the transformation that I was noticing. So I took it quite seriously, and after the program finished, I would do retreats and that sort of thing, and really continued to practice. I'd always had a bit of a psychological bent in my family practice, and working at the U of T in the counseling center, I did a fair bit of counseling, and I could really notice how much people were really ignoring their bodies and their symptoms, and trying to treat sort of psychologically based ailments from a physical perspective only. or from a medicine perspective only, and wanting the quick fix, and realized that, you know, there was way more to it than that, and came to understand that people needed to understand and participate in their own care, you know?
Right.
I can give you just a little example.
Sure.
You know, for many years, I also worked in a walk-in clinic, and people would come in for something, you know, as, well, it's very apropos now, but they'd come in with the flu, you know, they'd come in with aches all over, and they'd have fever, and they were, you know, lying on the examining bed, they just look like they'd been run over by a truck. And so I'd take a history, and I'd, you know, all those points would come up. I'd do an examination, and it was nothing defined, typical flu, no secondary complications. And so I'd say, you know, well, you know, you have the flu. Go home, go to bed, clear your calendar for the next week and take fluids, et cetera. Call me if this X, Y, and Z happens. Oh, but doc, they would say, I can't have the flu. Actually, you can, and you do. No, but I can't because I got a big meeting tomorrow. Okay, and what does that have to do with having the flu? But you see, we get so caught up in our automaticities of the way that we live. You know, we get so caught up in these that I can't do this, and I can't do that, and I'm going to Florida on the weekend with my kids, so I got to get better. So, you know, just give me something. And this is fundamentally the hook for me, is that people need to understand that, you know, nature has its ways, and the reality and the truth of the way things are not necessarily and usually not what we hope them to be or want them to be or wish they would be.
Right, right.
So I started to realize that there needs to be some fundamental shift in how people approach themselves and their health, and how also as a physician I need to approach people such that I could perhaps impart some better way of being with the way that things are.
Right. Yeah. And it's interesting, even going back, I think you said almost 20 years you've been in mindfulness, or even like the 10 years or so for me almost, it didn't seem, you know, it's very mainstream now, it seems, it's at least in people's consciousness. Do you see traditional doctors now all sort of, not all, but like more percentage of those doctors sort of leaning towards other options as well in terms of treating patients?
Yes, absolutely. It's really quite mainstream. I mean, I would probably say bar none, every major medical center in the GTA has a mindfulness a program, you know, associated with it. So it's no longer considered really out there or an alternative or some guru type culty thing from the 60s. You know, it really is mainstream. And one of the reasons for that, I think probably the main reason for that, is that in the last couple of decades, there's been a lot of research. There's been a lot of neuroscience. We now have the science to back up what, you know, contemplative practices have known for you know, 2,600 years, that we can reduce our sufferings as humans. So that piece, that neuroscience, and having some evidence base for these kinds of interventions, has really paved the way for it to be accepted, I think, in the medical model, Western medical model.
Anyway. Yeah, that's absolutely, that stuff's exciting. I mean, I'm sure you're familiar with Dr. Joe Spenza. I mean, some of his work is quite fascinating, and the brain scans to prove it. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. So Linda, you've studied, I didn't realize how many of the big names are, you know, out there, like Jack Kornfield, for example, is something I'm a huge fan and follower of. But so, you know, outside of Dr. Trivel, of course, because there's only one and only of Dr. T, but of all the people that you've studied with, is there one that stands out, like as the greatest influence on you personally and your practice currently?
So one that stands out, that's a hard question. Each of the teachers that I've had has really helped me to cultivate my practice in different ways. So, you know, sometimes I lean very much towards Jack Kornfield and Tara Brach and their sort of gentleness and compassionate kind of approach. And sometimes I lean more towards the Dan Siegels and, you know, tapping into my left brain, needing to understand what's happening. So, I suppose if I had to say overarching, it would probably be Jon Kabat-Zinn, and because I did train quite extensively at the University of Massachusetts under him, and so right. and reading all his books and that sort of thing. So he was probably the foundation from where then I branched out to these other people.
Is he still at that center in Massachusetts?
No, he's not. He's, retired, so to speak, but he still does lots of work. But I think the whole, that whole training aspect of UMass is now dissolved, and I think a lot of it's moved over to Brown's University. So,
okay.
Yeah, okay, been a bit of a transition there, yeah.
Okay, so I'm always fascinated with people's daily routines and practices. Do you have a specific regimen you follow daily around your practice or a morning routine that you do every day, or does it change from day to day?
It's mostly the same. When I'm at work and physically at work, and as you know, I commute about 4 hours a day, so my
yes.
day is long. But for the most part, I do my formal practices in the morning and do some yoga in the morning as well. And formally practice probably at least an hour every morning. And then I do another session generally in the evening, half an hour or so in the evening. But honestly, my meditative practice starts before I even open my eyes in bed, to be perfectly honest. You know, the minute I kind of wake up, I check in. I sort of do a little scan of my body. I sort of feel my body on the bed. I notice my heart rate. I feel the breath moving in and out. I feel the air. You know, I might notice the external sunlight coming in or hear a bird. I mean, I really start in that way. And then from there on, you know, as I roll over and notice how I go off the left side of the bed, not the right side of the bed. The moment my heel meets the floor and I start to roll that foot as I take one step, you know, and another towards the washroom, all of these things I try to embody from the minute get-go. But having said that, to your point, one does need, I think, very much so, a formal practice to keep that mindfulness muscle, you know, strong. So I tend to do an hour of formal meditation. I choose various ones depending on opportunity or necessity or interest. And again, I do it again at nighttime.
Yeah. That's interesting. Well, as Jon Kabat-Zinn says, and I might be butchering this quote, but he's the real meditation is how you live your life. So I think that's a perfect example of that informal meditation sort of in every moment as it unfolds.
Yeah, very much so.
In terms of the practice itself, you know, we've studied dynamic mindfulness together with yep. MindSight mm-hmm. and MBSR, which you lead. Do you do transcendental meditation?
No, not at all.
Not at all. Okay.
No.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's quite popular. I don't do a lot myself, only probably because I started with dynamic mindfulness and
I've been growing with that practice. It was very popular back, of course, in the 60s, right? And
right.
But, you know, transcendental meditation, from my understanding, is really a concentration, a very deep focused concentration, either on a mantra or some such thing. But it doesn't bring in the element of mindfulness that we know that's required for rewiring of the brain. So one can meet, and I'm not an expert in this, so I hesitate to say, but what I can tell you is that it doesn't have any of the evidence around how one can use the mind to rewire the brain to lead to more integration and transformation.
Interesting. I recall talking to Dr. Trimble about that in the past, and he mentioned something about the way the brain, actually the prefrontal cortex, isn't as engaged with TM versus dynamic mindfulness.
Right.
Nothing out of two, but
yeah.
So that's not to say through the quarantine.
Well, and that's not to say there aren't benefits of transcendental meditation. I'm sure there are, but it's just not the same. And I think that distinction is important.
Right.
Yeah. So how have I been managing?
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's a very good question.
4 extra hours every day, right?
Oh, loving that part of it.
Maybe 4 hours, but you know.
Oh, loving that part of it. I'm really enjoying a lot of self-care that I have been neglecting more than I probably should have. So, it's good. I have a routine. I try to, you know, as I mentioned, get outside every day and do my meditation. We have animals, so I spend a lot of time with the animals. And of course, it's not all fun and games, of course, because I've had to enter this sort of virtual world of learning to teach mindfulness online. Should I choose to do that, or teach self-compassion online? And there's been a huge learning curve around that, and how one has to alter the teaching, and you know, the pros and cons, and really how to develop and continue to have a therapeutic presence. You know, to be actually here and now when you're looking at 12 people on a screen, it's just so different for me. Yeah, so there's been some anxiety in there, but this is life, isn't it? There's right. anxiety within the yeah. family. There's financial, the domino effect of stress around that. So, sure. but with a mindful approach, one can simply, but not always easily, ride those waves, because we all have them. And whether it's COVID or whether it's some other, health issue or family issue, or be that whatever it may, whatever it is, it doesn't matter so much. It's really how do we then relate to that, such that we're not crashed down by each one of those painful things that are inevitably going to happen to us.
You know, so that's a great segue to another question. So, there's a lot of people right now who are completely isolated on their own with no physical human connection mm-hmm. at all, who don't have these skills and tools to deal with themselves mindfully. There's a lot of fear around, the virus itself, financial stress. Advice would you offer somebody who may be interested in starting a practice but hasn't started a practice? Is there some sort of first rung on the ladder to sort of help lead them in a direction of some relief from suffering?
I think there are. I think essentially, one of the first things, as you well know, is really to exercise and really pay attention to themselves, whether exercise. Now, we all know that exercise is good for us, but a lot of people, when they exercise, just go through it rotely and get their routine done and off they go, and really aren't even connected to their bodies. So just people starting to connect as they walk, pay attention to the walking, as they stretch, pay attention to the stretching, that sort of thing. Hugely important. And not only from a stress reduction point of view and anxiety point of view, but also we know that it primes the brain for rewiring. It actually is a huge substrate, if you will, to the rewiring. So exercise would be a huge thing. Simply said, encouraging people to do one thing at a time and pay attention to what they're doing. So often we're eating, or we're watching, whatever we're doing, we're not even there. We're already worrying about the next thing, and we miss those only moments we ever have to live by living in some of our own virtual world of our thoughts, ideas, opinions, and really miss these moments that are arising. So, fundamentally, mindfulness is not anything woo-woo out there. Mindfulness is simply being where we are while we're there. So this paying attention moment to moment. So, exercise, we can do it in that way. Any tasks, as you chop the vegetables, as you fold the laundry, notice how the towels feel. Notice what it feels like, how your arms move. Notice where your mind goes in terms of thoughts. Oh, my goodness, I'm worrying. Interesting. Noticing that. So we start to more and more get acquainted with how this organism runs, where the mind goes, what it feels like in the body physically, what we're feeling emotionally. So we start to tap into these things. Of course, if you want to take it a little bit deeper to develop more of a regular practice to actually hone in on ways to help us be more present. Certainly sitting by just sitting and noticing your breath, you know, feeling your breath. Now, and this is really important to feel the breath and not simply to think about the breath. And this is one of the biggest pitfalls people have when they first learn to practice mindfulness, is they're actually thinking about things rather than feeling them as they arise. So one would feel, for example, the expansion and notice how that feels in the front of the chest and the sides of the chest, what happens, you know, with the flow of air through your nostrils, that kind of thing. So really be in the body, in the sort of descriptive part of what we're feeling. So those will probably be the most important things to get started.
That's good info. Now, you mentioned not being much or overly familiar or comfortable with technology, but what about meditation apps? There seems to be more and more cropping up all the time. Do you have any familiarity with any of those?
Yeah, a little bit. You know, nothing wrong with apps. And in fact, there's probably there is benefit. There's no doubt about it. Certainly, if one, especially at the beginning, it's helpful to have some guidance, you know, in how to pay attention. And apps can offer that. But I think, you know, you have to kind of, you know, have to, mindfulness in the mainstream now, I mean, it can sort of be sort of this sort of wide view or a deep view. And there's many kind of layers of it. So people can kind of take sort of the approach of using mindfulness to help them calm down, for example, a 10-minute app or whatever. But knowing that really mindfulness is a way of being, that we need to be cultivating this in a more consistent way if we're hoping to have the transformative potential of that to rewire our brain such that we have more health and harmony in the long run. So it's not, so the downfall, I think, of apps is that they keep things fairly on the surface, such that your practice may not deepen in a way that one can have it deepen with more of a consistent practice with a teacher. Yeah. But having said that, you know, certainly 5 minutes is better than no minutes, and 10 minutes is better than five. And sometimes in our busy lives, and especially when we're very anxious, sometimes, you know, it's important to find those 5 minutes. So, and if an app allows you to do that, then go for it. You know, that's how I would say. But knowing that if you want to reach the sort of full liberation of suffering, that it's going to take more than an app.
Yes, right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Yeah, so anything, right? I mean, I've heard Dr. T say the only bad meditation is the one you miss.
And, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, so something is better than nothing.
Yeah.
I was on a radio show not too long ago. It was it was about stress. The topic was about stress and quarantine, and there was a psychotherapist on there that said that meditation really has no effect during an anxiety attack or some panic attack, I think is what they said.
And, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, I understand at some point, you know, meditation is really something to work on over time, to practice, to be proactive, to help you give you the tools and the skills to regulate. Do you feel there's a point, and I know this is like a pretty broad question, but when somebody's is feeling a lot of like extreme stress and anxiety, when is the point where you think mindfulness is not enough and they need to think about a psychotherapist or escalate into more of a medical environment?
Yeah. Well, the thing is that there's no mindfulness and there's no rewiring that can happen if you're dysregulated to the point of, you know, fight and flight. When you're in your... When you're in a panic attack, you're offline in terms of, you know, going into those parts of the brain that are required for mindfulness rewiring. So when somebody's dysregulated, when they're panicking, when they're hyper anxiety, when they can't put their attention on anything other than if they can take the next breath, then It's not the time to even try to be mindful. One has to get into this window of tolerance where we can be in what Borges calls the social engagement system, such those parts of the brain, the medial prefrontal cortex, can come online to help us do the work of mindfulness. So the first thing when somebody is panicking or high anxiety is to ground yourself, you know, to ground yourself in whatever way that looks like. Typically, initially, it's being, the further away from your body, the more grounding it is. For example, you may focus on something outside or something in nature or sound, something like that. Or we can ground in the body, in the soles of the feet. Some people find the breath grounding. Some people do not find it grounding when they're panicky. It actually makes them feel more panicky. So we need to regulate to get into this window of tolerance where then one can do the work of mindfulness. So it's not that one can't use mindfulness if you have a generalized anxiety or panic disorder, but nothing's going to happen in terms of mindful rewiring if you're actually in one of those acute dysregulated states. So it's very, very important that we stay within that window of tolerance. And this is particularly important for people who've had, you know, trauma. We don't want to just, you know, push past those boundaries and knowing how to pull back when to regulate. So mindfulness is not the panacea for everything, for sure. So having said that, we can also, even once having an established mindfulness practice, being more present, noticing thoughts, noticing feelings, noticing body sensations, you know, we may find that our story of these thoughts that go on and on and on, they just keep happening and we kind of get stuck in our transformation. We don't really feel more ease in our lives because we remain stuck in the narrative that we've created. And that's when psychotherapy is important to help us rework that narrative, to understand our stories, how it is that we, to make sense of how it is that we got to be this way and what's arising. So you can meditate, as I say, till the cows come home. Unless your psychodynamic house is in order, one can stay stuck. To expand on that a little bit, mindfulness in its full potential, let's put it like that, it requires, as Dan Siegel talks about, 9 different domains in our nervous system to be integrated. Our emotional system needs to be integrated. We need to be able to connect with our bodies. We need to be able to balance the left and the right brain. We need to be able to make sense of the different states and the different hats that we wear. So there's these number of domains of integration. And of those 9, 3 of them are not really well addressed through mindfulness. And that includes this narrative integration or interpersonal integration, and also a bit of memory integration. So what that means is that certainly we can get a lot of benefit from mindfulness, but until we can actually deal with the stories of our lives and make sense of those, we may well remain stuck. And that's where the role of psychotherapy comes in. I mean, some people can help themselves a bit with journaling and reflective practices, but generally you need sort of another person, another's attuned NPC, if you will, to be online to help us work through that and hit those blind spots where we just can't see why and how we get stuck in the way that we live our lives. Yeah.
Great. Thanks for that. Thanks for that. Makes sense. And I'm definitely bringing you with me on that next interview to jump in when I hit the wall on that one. So that was perfect. Thank you. Meditation for kids. What are your thoughts on that? I've been doing it with my own kids for a while, and I'm actually leading twice a week right now. I'm doing a kids meditation live through a popular Instagram channel. There they have they're doing all types of programs for adults and kids to keep everybody's bodies and minds moving. Nice. What are your thoughts on mindfulness for kids?
Well, you know what? Kids are naturally mindful until we teach it. To be honest, how often is it sitting there, playing with his pee on the plate at the dinner table and picking it up and rolling it in his fingers and smelling it and trying to put it somewhere. And we're like, come on, hurry up, Johnny. We got to go. Let's get out of here. We got to get this blocker, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, we very much interfere sometimes, well, more than sometimes, with our kids' natural mindfulness propensity. But having said that, I think it's really important as a parent to embody mindfulness, because that's what's going to be picked up, you know, through nonverbal means through our children. And yet, sure, there are very specific ways that one can foster mindfulness children. I think it's absolutely imperative that we do that to sort of counteract some of the academic, the ways that we teach our children, you know, it's very much left brain, critical thinking, problem solving, nothing wrong with that, but it needs to be balanced with the sort of right side, mindful, creative, present, attuned brain. And so age-appropriate mindfulness practices, absolutely. I mean, we wouldn't expect, you know, a six-year-old to do the same thing as a 10-year-old or a teenager or, you know, right, as an adult. So, but simply, you know, even in young kids, you know, you can be holding each other's hands and saying, well, can you feel mommy's heartbeat in your hand? Or can you look how juicy, what do you feel when you crunch into that apple? Oh, mom, it's so juicy. It's just all dripping down my chin. I mean, this is what we're talking about. It's just being there with our children.
Right.
And so, but not to undermine how important it is for us to be mindful and being there with our children and not,
you right,
know, thinking, yeah, about how to fix them while we're with them, you know? Yeah. So mindfulness.
Well, during those sessions, I am secretly aiming this at the parents because, yeah, as you said, we have so much unlearning and the kids are so naturally curious and mindful.
It's, yeah.
And they definitely model our behavior for sure.
For sure. And I think we should, in some ways, model their behavior and get on the floor with them and just be creative and make that fort in the bedroom and, you know, all these things that children just naturally play. And in fact, we have a lot to learn, as I mentioned, to learn from them. And one of the proponents of a healthy mind is Dan Siegel. He talks about this healthy mind platter. And one of the components to keep our minds healthy, as well as physical exercise and meditation and, you know, downtime, is actually playtime. And I don't mean structured play, soccer or hockey, but this sort of creative, free-flowing parts of the brain gets activated in ways that we don't generally, you know, shut down. And I can tell you, when I present that sort of thing in the MBSR program, often people will say, well, like, what does that mean? Like, how do I play? You know, we have lost so much this ability to just be free flowing in the moment creatively. And I think we can learn as much from our children as we can teach them in that regard. Yeah.
That's interesting. Yes.
Yeah.
So, one thing I forgot to ask you, if you were just to recommend one book for mindfulness, what's your favorite book?
Well, it depends on who I'm recommending it to. My favorite book might not be necessarily one I would recommend. I probably would go with something. I would probably go with something like Full Catastrophe Living, Jon Kabat-Zinn, or Wherever You Go, There You Are by Jon Kabat-Zinn, or Coming to Your Senses by Jon Kabat-Zinn. He writes a lot for the lay population, but yet is authentically putting forth the principles and practices of mindfulness. Yeah.
Dr. Linda McDonald, thank you so much for doing this today. And I just want to acknowledge you for everything you do. You had a huge impact on me as well, through teaching me as well. So I'm grateful for that. If people want to connect with you or learn more about you, obviously they can find more about you at mindful.ca. Is there any other channels that you want to put out there for people to contact you? Or is that the best way?
No, that's probably the best one. We have we have our website that they can access, and all our programs and things are on there. Yeah, probably the best way. Yeah.
Perfect.
Good.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your time today, and you have a wonderful day.
Well, thank you. Lovely connecting with you, Brian. We'll talk to you.